Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto hosting from Willow, Alaska. And on the line, we have our host, Hugh Neff, calling in from Duluth, Minnesota. He's been on a week-long tour of the Midwest there, South Dakota and Minnesota, talking to kids and meeting the fans of the Gypsy Musher. Hugh, how's it going?
Oh, you know, it's been quite a long week. Then basically almost like doing a race in a way, but it's a race that I really enjoy doing. And, you know, the kids really, I call this my motivational tour, because not only do I try to motivate them, but they're actually motivating me to do my best when I'm racing. So I'm had a great time, and, you know, I'm sort of a native wannabe, so it's been amazing. I got to, a couple days ago, my friends Amanda and Brad Simonson Price took me up to the top of Crazy Horse, and I got to actually walk on top of the monument, and that was pretty amazing. And I talked to a whole bunch of schools in Rapid City, got to talk to a native school of Oglala Sioux, which is, you know, a very humbling experience. And then, you know, got to do a show in Sioux Falls and hung out with the old president of Iditarod, not old, but the former president of the Iditarod, Lee Larson, and a whole bunch of folks. And then, of course, I'm in Duluth now, and, you know, I've heard so many stories about this area and seen a lot of the movies, you know, that were filmed in this area. So it's exciting. It's just sort of weird because there's really not that much snow here at all compared to Alaska.
Right, yeah. We've got pretty good dumping here in south central Alaska over the last few days. We spent about 4 hours digging out yesterday. So it's going to be a nice white Christmas for all of us down here, and for the folks in Duluth. I'm sure they're anxious to get some snow and get some training in for the Bear Grease. I understand you're heading over to that trail in a little while.
Yeah, I'm almost as pumped to see where Iron Will is made, dude, because like any musher, you know, that's, you know, been a big influence on what I, you know, aspired to do back in the day in Chicago when it first came out. And so to come see where Iron Will happened, it's pretty cool. So, yeah, and obviously the Bear Grease, you know, it's not only a race, but it's a race that honors the native musher, and that's going to be a pretty neat experience. I'm going to go visit dogbooties.com and so just check out the scene in Duluth, and then I got a long drive ahead of me because I'm going, you know, to hang out with my buddies up in the northern part of Milwaukee. So quite the long day still yet for me, even though I had an amazing, amazing talk this morning.
That's very cool. So let's talk about your time in South Dakota, and I want to spend a little bit of time about the area itself because it is a very cool and very spiritual place in terms of you know, spirituality with Native Americans and that sort of thing. But let's talk about the talk first. Who did you meet with first? You said you were in Rapid City. How did that talk go for the kids?
Well, you know, it just all worked together. I had my buddy Mike Pickell, you know, offered to take me to the Bears-Packers game, you know, which is on Sunday or on Christmas. And so I said, hey, if I'm going to be out here, I might as well, you know, do some tours and visit some folks. And then a lady that I had met up at the picnic for signing up for Iditarod this summer, Amanda, was just very persistent about getting me to come to Rapid City. You know, I'm used to going to a lot bigger places, a lot of Eastern, you know, East Coast cities and stuff like that, and to go to an area of the U.S. that, you know, like any, you know, kid from Chicago that was really into being an outdoorsman, I'm not much of a Kevin Costner fan, but I love Dances with Wolves. And so to go to that area and see where, you know, the area where it was filmed, that was just amazing, man. And just the whole Native lifestyle I learned about through, you know, being an Eagle Scout and Boy Scouts. And so, you know, life is a circle, and so to get out there and be able to talk to the kids there was really a humbling experience because Amanda's father's a Vietnam War veteran, and he showed me a lot of pretty amazing stuff. He was in planes a lot, and he had some amazing video from the war, and gave me a newfound respect for all the veterans, but I definitely have a soft spot in my heart for the veterans of Vietnam, because when I moved to Alaska from Chicago, you know, I only had a couple $100 to my name. And when I wasn't working for, you know, the Earharts or some of the mushers that I worked for, it was actually just local Vietnam veteran guys that knew that I was a hurting cowboy and barely even had a place to live, you know, back in the late 90s. And those guys helped me out, and my buddy Ray Fox and Anan and some other veterans really looked out for me. And so I'm hoping, you know, a lot of people are always looking for sponsors, and, you know, money's always tight with most mushers. But for me, I like to promote causes as well. So if I can figure out a way to help, you know, promote the veteran cause, I'm definitely going to try to do something like that for this year's race.
So were a lot of the kids out of school already for break, or did you just get them in time before they, you know, they got out of school for Christmas?
Yeah, that too was amazing. I think today was the last day of school for the kids here in Duluth, and you could see they were, you know, it's Christmas time, and they're pretty pumped to, you know, get the presents going and all that. But, yeah, a lot of the schools were just getting out the last day or so, and it just worked out, and I have a feeling I might do this in the future as well, because the way I train, I like to train early in the year and then sort of give the dogs a break before I start doing the races, and give my body a break as well. You know, I'm getting into my mid-40s, so I need to look out for my long-term future. And it's good for the dogs, you know, to get a break as well for me, I think. I think by the time I get back to Alaska, they're going to be ready to rock and roll once they see that daddy's home. But, yeah, the kids have been amazingly receptive. I think I've got some serious future mushers out there, especially in Duluth, obviously. There's a lot of history of dog mushing in this area. And not only did the kids put me in a good frame of mind, but I have a feeling that I motivated a lot of them, as well as a lot of teachers. And I think I probably had close to a couple dozen just parents that were at this last talk, and lots of media and stuff like that. So it was an event more than a talk. It was a pretty big deal today. We had the head of the NEA, the Teachers Association of Minnesota, flew in from the Twin Cities just to come to my talk. So that was a pretty humbling experience, and it was exciting because he's heard about me. He actually knows what I call my boss. Her name is Barb Ann Gayek, and she's the president of NEA in Alaska. And so it was pretty, it's a small world out there, you know. Everything just sort of fell together. And it was great because the kids, I was blown away how not only literate they are, but how well knowledge they are about dog mushing. We're talking like first, second grade kids, little 8, 9, 10-year-old kids that knew quite a lot about the history of mushing. And these kids actually had been visited by Lance last year when Red Paw had them out here. So they're well versed in Iditarod. And I do a lot of my talk. You've been to my talk, Robert. In fact, you were a sponsor of one of my talks in the Denver area. And, you know, I'm not just about dog mushing. I'm trying to teach life skills and teach about teamwork and, teach about, you know, perseverance and, that in life, often you do well when you're trying to help those around you instead of just caring about yourself all the time. That's what I really try to do in my world. It's, people might think I'm a celebrity, whatever that means, but I'd rather, you know, help other mushers and help races and make my dogs famous more than, you know, making me famous.
You know, Hugh, I don't think any other musher is out doing talks at this time of year, so I think that kind of bodes well to your name, the Gypsy Musher. You're out floating around 2,000, 3,000 miles from home while everybody else is either digging out the yard or preparing for races. But like you said, you need to give the dogs a chance to rest. You need a chance to recoup mentally and physically. I know you've done a lot of miles already in this short season. You've been on the runner since the beginning of October, where you're lucky enough to have snow and whatnot up in Tok. So when you're at these talks, Hugh, how do you switch from, you know, the guy in the bush, the typical Alaskan to the motivated speaker, the guy that's in front of kids? How do you go back and forth, if you can tell us about that?
Well, first of all, my dogs are being run, just little fun runs with my buddy Jesse Holmes back in Tok. And even though I might be a 3 or 4,000 miles away from Alaska, you know me, I always bleed blue and gold, I'm always about Alaska. So to get motivated about talking about dogs or Alaska, I mean, you know me, dude. If anything, you got to tell me when to shut up. And that's probably why I don't have any real tight best friends, perhaps, in Alaska in the north, is because most people can't handle being around me for more than an hour or two because I've got a lot of energy. And, you know, I use this tour not only to teach the kids, but I'm using them as a motivation for myself to keep me more focused on trying to do well instead of just being out there having fun in the woods with the dogs. It's good to have fun and everything, but I think I have a little bit more determination if I know that kids are wanting me to do good, and I'm hoping to do good for them, you know?
And, you know, that's exactly what I was looking for is you know, the kids are the motivators. They're the ones that are the future of this sport. You know, a lot of the guys in Iditarod, they're getting older. You know, the Kings and the Swensons and all and the Mackeys and like you said, you're in your mid 40s. So something has to happen.
But I'm a kid. Let's get that straight.
Me too. I'm only 40, so I'm 3 or 4 years behind you. But my point is you said earlier that a lot of these guys could be potential future mushers. How do you spark
exactly
that imagination with those guys? You know, that especially in the Duluth area, they're familiar with it. Like you said, the bear grease is going on there. Lots of families in that area are mushers. Maybe not long distance. You know, they have the sled and the dog in the backyard, and they're taking it on the trails. How do you spark that imagination for those young guys?
Well, it's definitely easy in Duluth because just being here for, you know, got in yesterday, and if you think about all the famous mushers, you know, Iditarod and other races that come from Minnesota, it's really phenomenal. You go from Swenson, you got Paul Gebhardt, you got, you know, Brent Sass is an up-and-comer, you got Ken Anderson. I mean, the list goes on and on. Jamie Nelson, Tim White obviously is one of the guys that designed a lot of the sleds that we use, and a lot of us have used his runner plastic throughout the years. And obviously you got Eddie Streeper and a lot of the sprinters as well. So there's a lot of history in this area. I go back and tell the kids a little bit of my history, tell them, you know, about how I really didn't even know much about dog mushing as a kid, but I loved just dogs. And I just talk about, you know, what dogs have done for me in my life and how, even though I'm a pretty hyper-eccentric person nowadays, you know, back in the high school days, I pretty much just hung out with my dog all the time. I had a dog named Maverick, and he's the one that taught me, you know, that dogs are just a very special creature, and he's the one that motivated me to get even more dogs. So I just try to explain to the kids just about seeking goals in life and finding a passion and trying to approach this world, especially in this day and age, in a way that is simplistic. You try to simplify what you're all about, and yeah, you just have to, you know, you're going to be challenged. You can't hide from, you know, being challenged in this world, and you have to just limit your stress. And when life is tough, you have to figure out a way to get through those times. And if any musher can be a symbol of, you know, having hard knocks throughout the years, I don't think anybody even comes close to what I've had to deal with over my, you know, career. But, you know, I'm learning. And I'm learning that the more I do, the more I learn. So that's why I guess I'm so motivated, not only with these talks, but, you know, with dog mushing too. That's the toughest thing about, obviously, these talks is being off a sled for 10 days. You know, it's sort of nerve-wracking. You really want to get out in the woods. And since there's hardly any snow this year, being in this area of Duluth, at least there's a little bit, so I could sort of remember, you know, how many feet of snow we have back in Tokë. But the nice thing is the last couple of schools, there's actually been sleds. So I'm definitely getting to play on the sled in the gymnasium or whatever. And, you know, I call my sled my dance partner. And for me, a lot of people think 1,000-mile race is just, you know, a competition, a workout, and scary and all that. But for me, it's just a big, you know, dance. And I can't wait to get back to Alaska so I can start dancing again.
So how about the parents? You said that there was a lot of folks there at all the talks. Are they just as motivated to hear you talk as the kids are?
Yeah. They're not as fanatical as, you know, some of these teachers can be. But the teachers are sort of, you know, they're obviously the ones that get me to come and visit. And I think the kids feed off their teacher's energy. You know, that's why I learned so much about, you know, teachers by watching how well-mannered their kids are. And I've been to, you know, I've done hundreds of these talks, and I can see a lot of schools where the kids are well-mannered and polite and respectful. And then I see other schools where the kids are all about themselves and, you know, don't have respect for their elders. And that's, you know, those kids have issues, obviously, but I think a lot of that has to do with, just like being a dog musher, is how you form a plan and how you execute, how you nurture your children or your kids that you're teaching. And that's why the dog mushing is so great in the classroom, because it's a great metaphor how we put our team together and, you know, how these kids are trying to, you know, grow up and learn as well. And so I just teach the kids that, you know, you got to get along, you got to be a team player, and to try to control their energy. Because we all know what happens when people have too much energy in the beginning of races. They're probably not going to have that much energy in the end of races. And so it's very important to try to tone down and be patient and just, you know, wait for the magic moment to make your move. And that's what I'm hopefully my story is obviously quite unique. Not too many guys from Chicago doing what I'm doing. Heck, there's not too many guys from Alaska doing what I'm doing. But hopefully people get a little bit of what I'm trying to express and use that to their advantage in what they're doing in their own personal worlds.
I think you're doing a great thing, and I know a lot of other folks would second me on that. My last point on that, Hugh, in terms of preparing for life and doing these types of talks, and when you're talking to the kids, you mention all the time about being a Boy Scout and being an Eagle Scout and that sort of thing. How does that prepare a young man for life in today's age versus, you know, versus how it used to be? You hear a lot of kids these days thinking that scouts are corny, and, you know, I don't want to wear a dorky uniform and that sort of stuff. But how do you think that prepares young men for the life, whatever it may entail, whatever trail that they may follow, I guess?
Oh, I know. It's, you are what you are, but you know what? Sooner or later, a lot of kids these days put masks on, trying to be cool. They all want to be hip and Justin Bieberish, whatever that means. But, you know, if you're fake, people are going to figure that out sooner or later. And so, yeah, it was the same way back in my day. If you're not the jock in football or, you know, the star basketball player and you're doing Boy Scouts, they might think you're a nerdy or a dork or whatever, but, you know, whatever. It got me out in the woods. It got me to respect the native lifestyle, and I'm definitely, you know, a huge proponent of the wilderness. And people are going to judge you no matter who you are or what you do in life. And people probably have a lot of thoughts and probably think they know me. And, you know, I know that what I do out in the woods or with the dogs is between me, the dogs, the land, and the great almighty. So I don't really I'm not into people who are judgmental or who are, you know, naysayers or nitpickers and trying to tell you how to do things. I think teach their own, and it's up to you to figure out, you know, who you are, really, is what this world is about. And that's the beauty of dog mushing. When you're out in the trail in the middle of Alaska and it's 40 below and it's just you, the dogs, and nobody else, you're going to figure out who you are. So, yeah, Boy Scouts is great, man. I personally think if you know, I was a little bit more powerful in this world, I would probably have all these kids, not necessarily in Boy Scouts, but in some type of organizations that gave them a little bit more discipline. Because, you know, my dad was a military vet, and he had me working. I had a paper out when I was 10, 11 years old, you know. I, in the summers, used to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, and I'd be going down the street, you know, throwing papers in people's houses and hopefully not hitting their windows. But it gives you a sense of responsibility, and it gives you a respect for money. And I think, obviously, a lot of the problems and issues with not only kids but professional athletes, I'd say, is they're just being given too much and they're being put on pedestals and they're losing their humbleness. And I think once you are just become full of yourself and don't realize, you know, that we're all just human, that I think you're going down the wrong path.
Totally agree there, Hugh. So what's next in the school tours? I know you head out usually after the season, late May, early June, that type of time. What's on the schedule for spring, early summer?
I'm doing the same old school tour I do. I'll fly into Chicago the first week of May, and then I get a rental, and I do the Chicagoland area, the Midwest, and then I'll be heading towards New York, the East Coast, down south. And what I'm really looking forward to, in May I'll do about 25 to 30 schools, and it's way more exhausting than doing Iditarod or Quest. By the end of that, I'm just totally, completely exhausted, but it's more than worthwhile. I really love doing it. That being said, I'm even more pumped up because I've got some connections now, and my big goal for next year is I'm going to do a reservation tour and go to hopefully Pine Ridge and Rosebud and some of the most impoverished third world areas in the U.S. And there are parts of the U.S., believe me, that are third world. And it's not just the economy of the last couple of years. It's been like this pretty much this whole century and the century before. And those are the people that I respect because I think the native people have a deeper bond with the land. And for me, a lot of people, are really gung-ho American, and that's good and all, but more than just being an American, I love the land of North America, and I think we as a people need to respect it more.
Totally agree there as well. So let's talk about the tour itself for you in terms of what you were able to visit before the school tour. You know, so many people love to hear about your adventures. I know you went to the Badlands and Deadwood and Crazy Horse and that sort of thing. So tell us a little about that. So many of your fans and followers like to hear what the Gypsy Musher is out exploring. Tell us about Deadwood. How did you find that? I know you were hit up Wild Bill's grave and Calamity Jane's and all that.
Before I get to that, let me just talk about Crazy Horse real quick, because I think a lot of people have a misconception about the whole Crazy Horse deal. Because I always thought with the Crazy Horse monument that most Native people wouldn't think it was respectful to Mother Nature to be doing that, you know, tearing apart a mountain and putting an emblem up there of that magnitude. But they don't realize that Standing Bear, who's a Native chief and a bunch of other chiefs, actually back in the, I believe, late 70s, early 80s, actually came and talked to a guy from Boston, a Polish fellow named Korczak, and they asked him to do this because they had seen some of the sculptures this fellow had done. And so this guy is doing he's not around anymore, he's passed on, but his family is continuing the vision. And basically, this fellow, Korczak, was in the first few years doing it all by himself, you know, walking up and down the side of this mountain there just outside of Rapid City and, you know, forming this face, and then there's going to be the horse as well. And basically, that's just not for Crazy Horse, who's a great warrior, but it was actually to represent all Native people. And what their vision was to let the white man know that you might have Mount Rushmore, but we have our Native heroes too. And that's the whole beauty of that. And it was very humbling because not only, I mean, I was really, when you're up there, you just feel there's a weirdness to it, but it's pretty intense. But his wife is still alive, and she's not only motivated to keep it's going to take, you know, probably another 50 years until it's completed, if not longer. But his wife, like, gave me a package and, you know, wrote me a nice little message, and she knew who I was and everything. So she's, like, in her mid-80s. Her name's Ruth. And that was pretty cool. And the amazing thing about this whole vision with Crazy Horse is they will not take any government money. They want,
right.
They're all about, you know, independence and, you live by what you can create. And it's pretty awesome. But that being said, from there we went to Deadwood. And Deadwood isn't exactly what I thought it would be like. You know, I'm a big, I watched all the episodes on HBO with Al Swangren, and, you know, we have the whole litter. I've got an Ellsworth and Tolliver, and you get to Deadwood, and that Deadwood actually burnt down, like in 1870 something, and so it's all a lot. It was rebuilt with brick, So it's not like what you would think. I thought it was going to be more like Skagway or Dawson City, or it was a bunch of old wooden sidewalks and buildings, but it's really not like that. It's more of a gambling town. That being said, being up on the in the cemetery, it was like getting right. We got there right before dark, Brad, Amanda, and I, and so that was sort of cool. And the weirdest part about seeing the Wild Bill Hickok, grave was they've got a bust of him, just like, you know, the one that Jim Morrison has in Europe, in France. And so that was sort of cool to see, you know, Wild Bill's face right there, sort of in the dark. But then they had a plaque. And I looked on the plaque, and it said where he was from and everything. And I didn't realize that he's actually from Illinois, so from a place called Troy, Illinois. So that was pretty intense. And obviously, Calamity Jane is buried right next to him. And there's a lot of stories about, you know, what went down. And they've got a couple bars that, you know, Saloon Number 10 is where it actually happened at. But some other bars say that they have relics of when the incident where he got shot in the back happened. But the interesting thing about Deadwood is that the street of Deadwood isn't actually where Deadwood, the actual street, used to be. The alley behind all the buildings. So a lot of these tourists, I think they're shopping, going up and down the street, going, oh, this is where it all happened. They don't even realize it happened another street over. But that's why I'm always asking in questions and investigating, because sometimes if you want to get the real truth, what really happens in situations, you have to go past what you're going to hear in the media or what you're going to read about in a book.
Totally. My wife and I were there just this past spring. We went to, actually June, we went to Deadwood and that whole area where you were visiting. I tell you what, that Crazy Horse Monument, that's something spectacular. And you know, maybe the listeners don't know this, but all of the kids in the Korshak family were kind of enlisted to help out with that. And all of them agreed to do that. And most of them did it throughout the rest of their lives. Many of them are still working for the family to do that. They're cruising along, but a lot of people don't understand, if they've never been there, Crazy Horse, it's like four or five times the size of Rushmore. It's not some puny little monument. It is a huge ordeal, isn't it, Hugh?
Yeah, I mean, Mount Rushmore would fit inside of the head of Crazy Horse.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the deal. The horse is going to be much bigger than the actual head. And, you know, it's great that the name of the monument is Crazy Horse, because the whole thing of what this guy did, I mean, this Korshak guy is just, it was crazy, man. He's taking apart a mountain to make this huge monument. And he had to walk up and down these stairs over and over again with a jackhammer. And they've got it set up where it's in operation now. So it is going to be completed. But like I said, they're not in any hurry. They want to do it right. They want to respect not only the mountain, but the people as well, the Lakotas and the people of the area. And they're actually at the base of the hill. That's going to be a Native American university, and that's the vision this Standing Bear and the other chiefs had back in the day. And when that gets developed, I hope it's in my lifetime, because that is just going to be phenomenal. It looks really amazing. I was just blown away.
That area there has a heck of a lot of history in terms of the American West, and anybody that's listening, if they're history buffs, definitely read up on Crazy Horse or read the book Black Elk Speaks or any of those other Native
and
American books.
And the funny thing, coming from Alaska, Robert, you would know this, everything back in the lower 48 just seems smaller and tiny. And so, and the roads, of course, are in much better shape because they don't have the permafrost and the bumpy roads and all that. So I just look back in the history of, you know, when I was in my 20s or in college, and I just wish I'd gone and explored more of the U.S. And I've been to almost every state. There's only a few I haven't been to. But, I mean, that whole area is not that far from, like, Minneapolis or Chicago or, you know. But, you know, it's not just the monument. It's the Black Hills. There's just a lot to do in that area. And the Badlands were just, you know, that's formed by, I believe, lava flows. And the Badlands are where the old, you know, outlaws used to go and hide from, you know, the bounty hunters or the sheriff or whoever was after them. So very stark landscape, but beautiful. It was very cool to check out. But, I mean, I love, you know, nature and everything, but compared to Alaska, let's face it, there's only one Alaska. That's why I can't wait to get back home and get to the Denali Highway and start doing some racing here soon.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's switch gears a little bit. I know we want to talk about the sled dog of the week with Ellsworth, but I know you're coming back this week and getting ready for a race, a mid-distance race, the Gen Gen. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, I fly out of Milwaukee Tuesday, and then I get in, and hopefully by the grace of, you know, good luck, I'll make it on time. But I get back to Anchorage about midnight-ish, and then I got to jump in my dog truck and boogie up to Paxson, or I think it's Myers Lake is where they're starting this year, the Gen Gen, whichever place, and just jump on a sled and do a couple hundred-mile race. And, you know, it's a race, but more than anything, it's a training run. I got a lot of youngsters, and Jesse's going to be running some of his dogs with some of my dogs as well, so we'll have two teams in the race. And I know Paul signed up, and my buddy Jake, and of course, you know, a lot of the ladies as well, and they're quite competitive, obviously. And they're the ones that have why I got a diet, try to get down to a reasonable weight where I can, you know, not have my dogs have too much extra kibble to be carrying in my stomach. And it's just a fun way to start the season off. It doesn't have as big a field, which I like. I think the dogs might perhaps learn more, not be as stressed out because there won't be as many teams. And it's been a great race, and John and Zoe have done, you know, wonders with it to keep it going in this day and age. A lot of mushers want to complain about trail marking or purses, and it's easy to complain in this world. What John Channelmeyer does for dog mushing on a year-in, year-out basis, not too many other mushers are doing. So my hat's off to him.
Yeah, they do some pretty good things up there with their kennel and their races and that. What is that New Year's weekend or is it the following weekend, Hugh?
It's right before New Year's, actually. We should be done. I believe it starts on the 28th, so we'll be done by the 30th is when the banquet is. And I did it a few years ago, man, and even though it's a couple hundred miles, it was a crazy race. There were some windstorms, and it was pretty wild race, but it's beautiful country. I mean, there's a reason Sebastian's been out there running dogs for so many years, and obviously that's his little backyard, so Jeff King. And so it's just gorgeous country, and I like to get the dogs, you know, out of the regular training trails and get them on a little adventure trip. My buddy John Larson is actually going to be driving to Tok, and he's going to be picking up the dogs and the, you know, gear and all that, and Jesse, and then meet me in Paxson. So I'd just like to say thanks to him for being a part of the team. So John's the great guy. He's in a lot of the websites when all the races are happening. John's the guy who's making comments all the time and cheering the mushers on. And he's, I think, a guy like him or any other people that are not just into dog mushing, but they're doing it in a positive light and that are really trying to promote what we're all about. Those are the folks that are you know, I really like to see getting more and more involved with the sport.
Yeah, I agree with you. Lastly, let's talk about the sled dog of the week. Today you're going to talk about Ellsworth. I know he's done some Iditarods and some quests, and he's one of your premier dogs there. So let's talk a little bit about Ellsworth.
Yeah, Ellsworth, named after a character. If you guys remember the guy with the beard from Deadwood and on HBO, and he's part of that litter. He's my big boy. He's got rye nose, so his nose sort of is crooked, and he's actually got some vision issues in his eyes because of it. Martin Boozer actually saw him a couple years ago in the Cantwell race and was telling me that he's seen it before in dogs, and he explained to me what it was all about. And he's a special dog. There's just something about his personality. He's very loving, not only to me, but he's just, it's not like he's overly loving, but he's a dude. I mean, he communicates with everybody that comes up and pets him, and not like an incredible, you know, special leader, say like Annie or Jewel or one of those dogs, but he's just, you know, he's a solid dog that is, I believe he's going on 5.5, and he's already done 6,000 or 7,000 milers, so he's just steady Eddie, usually right in the middle of the team. Type of dog that I put my spazzes next to, and he's going to try to mellow him out for me if they try, you know, these younger boys, typically if they try to nip at him or mess with him, he just gives them a little whack with his rear end and, you know, keeps them in line because he's bigger than them. So I like him a lot. He's one of those dogs that you just can't help look at, and they just put a smile on your face because he's just so a little bit goofy looking, but in a good way. And he's interesting because when I let his litter loose to run around the yard and play, he's the one dog that just hangs out by his house and just, you know, he's a homeboy.
And you said he's 5.5?
I believe right in there. And Tyler, Delilah, and Tolliver are his siblings. Maestro's his dad. And the weird thing is that whole litter is all blonde dogs, but their mother is Omen, who is a dog from Lance, and that I've had, I don't know, 6-7 years now. And she's pure black hound dog. She's the dog that Lance gave me because Lance, you know, if there's a dog with issues, he's got enough good dogs where he doesn't really need to deal with that. So he was trying to help me out back in the day when I was a nobody. And basically the dog didn't want to leave checkpoints. So it was pretty embarrassing there for about 3 or 4 years when I had her in the Iditarod every year. I would have to put her in the sled and carry her out of checkpoints. And then I got a mile out and I put her back in the team. And the reason I put up with it was because Omen would literally lope the whole 1,000 miles. She finished every race. Ellsworth's mom, Omen, was pretty funny because one year I came into Nome into the finish line and the St. Patrick's Day parade was happening. And so, you know, there's all these people going down the street, you know, and Omen was in lead going down the street and she literally tried to jump through a car window into this guy's truck like 2 seconds from the finish line. Because, you know, she's one of these, you know, girls that spends a lot of time on the couch and everything.
Still on the line? She was still on the tug?
Yeah, dude. It was a classic moment in time. But Omen, she's a sweetie. But she spends a lot of time on the couch. She's just, probably about, I don't know, 10 or 11 now. So she's just chilling.
So a couple of people have asked on the chat and things in previous shows. You've always talked about older dogs for your races, and we've talked about this before about, you know, them being prepared around 3 and whatnot. One of the questions we got last show, right as the show was ending, was what are you looking for in terms of the future with your dogs in raising pups? Are you looking to have a whole bunch more pups, or are you very selective? How do you go about for the future?
I'm definitely trying to keep my yard at 35 to 45 dogs. I think that's reasonable. I think you can give all the dogs enough attention, and I just think it's proper animal husbandry. I think the days of huge dog yards are definitely, hopefully, you know, a thing of the past. I think with this economy, it's unless you have a tourist operation or you've got a lot of sons or kids that are going to help you out, it's pretty tough to be taking care of more than 30, 40 dogs by yourself or with one person helping. But what I look for as far as breeding goes, I'm going away from speed. I've got enough speed. Every year I have one of the fastest teams. Speed doesn't win Iditarod, I don't believe. I think it's just overall efficiency and the best dog team. And it's not about having a bunch of Yankee superstars anymore. It's about having a solid team. And that's why I've got all the best lines out there pretty much. And I prefer to have the old school dogs. I'm going back to what Lester and some of my older native elder friends would say are the native village dogs that haven't been around in a while, and that's why I've been getting some dogs from my buddy John Baker. I'd always go visit my buddy Ray Reddington, and I'd look at his yard, and it'd be like looking at an old Iditarod poster of, you know, Joe Reddington's dogs. And I just want to have less of a North American for a rendezvous sprint-looking team, which I did a bunch of quests with and Iditarods, and they're good. They're athletic, but much more high maintenance. I think Sebastian talked about it in last year's Iditarod video, and it's just those huskies that are just powerful and steady and just good attitudes. And I think, in a way, the less hound you have in these dogs, the more human-like they are. And that's why I think I'm going more towards that style of dog, because they're a little bit easier to take care of, and as I mature in this world, that's what I'm looking to find is a team that's going to be easier on my body. Sometimes, you know, these folks show up at races and they cannot control their dog teams because they just have too much energy. I think you need an efficient team more than just a fast, powerful team. You need a team that's not going to go too fast and they ain't going to slow down.
So do you think that the sport is leaning more towards that, more of the husky-type dogs? You know, the hound dog crosses were very popular for the last few years, and I know that, you know, the Norwegians and all those guys were very heavy into that. Do you think we're going back more towards that husky-type dog here in the future?
To each their own. I'm sure there's a lot of mushers out there listening to my show to try to pick stuff up, and they're probably going, oh, what's this guy talking about? This isn't how you do it, and that's their opinion, but we all do it differently. This is just my style. I've been yelled at by former Iditarod, multiple Iditarod champions, who are telling me, oh, you guys aren't doing it right, and we would have never done things like this back in our day. But, hey, I mean, look what John did last year. He proved that his method works, and his method, I don't know if he necessarily learned as much, say, from Sorley as Lance picked up over the years, but it's like the tortoise and the hare, you know, you get your choice. And for me, I just believe that overall going at a more steady, perhaps a bit slower pace is going to be conducive for the overall health of your dog team, and you're going to have a lot less stress on them, and you're going to have more dogs in the long run. I saw Sebastian, you know, we were together for, 500-600 miles last year, and I saw the way he trained, and it was amazing to watch. I mean, not only was he on the brakes going down mountains, Sebastian was going down mountains making his dogs pull him down the mountain. That's how hard he was on the brake. And he was doing that for a reason, because he wanted his dogs to pull. And that's more than anything, whether you have a fast dog or a slow dog, I want a dog that's attacking their harness. And hopefully my dogs will be doing that here in the next week or two. We're going to have quite a busy schedule when I get back home, my friend. I'm going to be doing as much traveling in Alaska as I'm doing right now.
So let's end it on that, Hugh. What are you thinking about the next show? I know about this time next week you'll be on the trail of the Gen Gen race. When are you thinking about the next one?
Oh, solid performance. I'm just, you know, looking to see how I've got a lot of youngsters. I bred up a dog with a dog I got from Ken Anderson, and see how they're looking. They're going on three. I've got a lot of youngsters that are out of Annie. I've got about 15 two-year-olds that'll be 2 to 3 year olds that are going to be in the Gin Gin, and you know, always happy to be on the trail with Annie's Army, which is a lot of fun. And this will be my first race for some of the John Baker dogs that I've acquired this year, so it's going to be just an experiment, and still seeing how I do with sponsors and all that, to see if I'm able to afford to go to Bethel this year. That can be a little pricey with you know, flying out the dogs and all that, but I've already talked to Mike Williams, and if I can make it happen, I'd love to go to Bethel. I love doing village races, and of course my buddy Ray Reddington is making me come down and visit him for a while and do the Kinnick race, which I just love. You know, hanging out with the Reddingtons is always an experience, and I always learn something from those folks. So I like doing these smaller races with the younger dogs, you know, give them a little bit of experience, and then perhaps with the Cusco, I'll be putting together a little bit more of a solid team to see, you know, how they compare with the big boys of the sport that I'm aspiring to be like one day. Robert? Hello? Shit, we lost him. What happened, though? That's weird. Yeah, how do I do that? What the heck just happened? Let's do 9-2 again. Where's that paper at? Hello?